Patients never once wonder to enter the house, because wonder is a wretched guest. It uses all of you, but it is not careful with what is most fragile or irreplaceable. If it breaks you, it shrugs and moves on. Without asking, wonder often brings along dubious friends. Doubt, jealousy, greed. Together, they take over, rearrange the furniture in every one of your rooms for their own comfort. They speak odd languages but make no attempt to translate for you. They cook strange meals in your heart that leave odd tastes and smells. When they finally go, are you happy or miserable? Patience is always left holding the broom.
Jonathan Carroll, reading from the opening paragraph of it from his latest novel, White Apples. My name is Rick Kleffel, and welcome to Fine Print. Mr. Carroll is the author of 12 novels, 2 novellas, a collection of short stories, and has written for both film and magazines. His previous novel, The Wooden Sea, was selected as a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and one of the top books of 2001 by the San Francisco Chronicle. White Apples is a whirlwind, big-screen romance full of wonder, snappy dialogue, and jaw-dropping analogies. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks very much.
A sense of wonder plays a big part in your novels. This emotion is usually evoked by reading and usually only found in science fiction, yet you managed to find it in cosmopolitan life and romance.
I think that one of the things that's really terrible about growing older is that we lose our sense of wonder. It's better to be cool, it's better to be knowledgeable, and we push away this thing that made us human in many respects, and that is the sense of wonder. We see it in kids, you know. Kids laugh out loud and kids' jaws drop and they go wow and all this stuff, but we don't. And a friend of mine once said to me a very shocking line. They said, "You never show your teeth when you smile," and I think it's along the same lines. You know, it's better to be reserved. It's better to be cool. Show no wonder, etc., etc. And in my books, that's what I'm trying to do, to show the sense of wonder in a very, very grounded world.
Now, how do you make that discovery in this cosmopolitan life of bon vivants and wastrels that you follow in your novels?
I just, you know, you write about what bites you. I come up with a bunch of, you know, I think the writers are divided into two groups, those who know exactly what they're doing from the beginning, and they just connect the dots, and those who have absolutely no idea, and I'm one of those guys. And so what I usually do is to begin with a character who interests me, you know, a guy who, in the case of White Apples, who loves women. He just loves women. And what kind of life does he live? What kind of situations has he gotten himself into? Where is he going? And from there, the book sort of unravels towards more and more sureness on my part of where I'm going. But from the beginning, I really have no idea.
Now, women play a big role in White Apples and in all of your work. Could you talk about women in your life and in your work?
Sure. I have no male friends. All of my friends are women, because I just think women are more interesting than men. I think they're deeper. And I always say men look straight ahead, whereas women look north, south, east, and west, and straight ahead. And they're much more willing to take chances and to dig deep and to think harder about stuff. Men have these kind of success agendas, you know, I want to get here because then I can achieve that and this and that. Women will sit and chat with you about something forever, not needing to find a solution, because the fun is in the discussion. Men want solutions, and they fascinate me much more than men do.
Now, children also play a role in your novels. In White Apples, they herald a fairly intense and dark scene. And in other parts of the same novel, they're just more joy of the life for living. Could you talk about children in your novels?
Well, I taught school for many years, and so I had a kind of link to them. I think that kids are both great and horrible, but because it's not politically correct to say kids are horrible, we don't do it. We just say, you know, they're rambunctious or they're whatever. They're not. Look in any sandbox, and you'll see one kid hitting another kid on the head with a shovel. And that's terrible, but at the same time, you know, they'll laugh like we don't laugh because they, you know, they have the sense of wonder or whatever it is. In White Apples, I played with kids as being not so good, but in the previous book, The Wooden Sea, probably the second most important character in the book is a teenager. So, you know, there's always an either-or quality to it with me.
Now, your novels focus on human emotions, and you have some unusual methods for getting to the heart of those emotions in your characters. Do your emotions do you perceive the emotional state of the character and then make the journey there, or is the journey there the method of perceiving the emotional state of the characters?
Usually I create a situation and then I say, how would this guy react? I mean, you know, I'll put the guy on the moon and then think, you know, is he lonely or is he happy or does he feel like tap dancing or does he wish he had a Dr. Pepper? It's not usually the other way around, because I find myself in the same situation. I mean, you know, if I get stuck in a foreign city and I don't have any money in my pocket, there's your situation. How are you going to deal with it? In the case of most of the characters in my books, for example, in White Apples, a guy who's a real, he fools around, he's a kind of Lothario, he finds the love of his life, finally, and she leaves him. Now what? This, how he reacts is what interests me, not so much the situation that, you know, this has happened to him, but here's a guy who forever has been on the winning side in that sense of relationships, and in this case, he finally found the one and he loses. How would he react?
Well, you have a lot of fun with that, especially in your dialogue. Now, are you just an excellent eavesdropper, or are you saving all your best retorts for your novels?
I don't know. I mean, I live in Europe, and so basically I live in a German-speaking country, and what's interesting is that I speak good German, but I can turn it off when I want to. When I come to America, which is infrequently, one of the things that's both wonderful and horrible is I can't turn it off. So I find myself just sort of not doing anything else but listening all the time, the way people, you know, say this and that and do this and that. And I think that having been here now just for a few days, having not been in America for 7 years, I realize that you think more about language when you don't have it around you all the time. So, for example, because I live in a German-speaking country, I think more about English because it's a rarer thing. Whereas if I were here, it's like the equivalent of going into a little market and going into Kmart. You know, if I lived here, it's Kmart, but living in Europe, it's the little market. So you're delighted to find the one, you know, can of cashews that they do have instead of the 79 varieties of Kmart.
Your characters are faced with choices in your novels, and they often get to see there was more than one result from a single choice. Could you talk about how the part that choice and regret play in your novels?
I think that's true about my novels and life or whatever it is. I mean, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, you know, the worst thing of all is regret. But, you know, regret is inevitable because we're always going to go left or right, you know, the road not taken. And sometimes it damns us and sometimes it saves us. But it's not always our decision. You know, it's you know, my mother died and I had to go live in Arizona, or you know, my leg was cut off and I couldn't play basketball, that sort of stuff. I think that that choice plays more a part of our destiny than we like to admit, because we don't like to admit that we made too many wrong choices.
Now, do you feel that the regret is more poignant when it's for something done or something not done?
Ah, that's a nasty question. To me, my own experience, not done. You know, it's this idea, and I wrote about it in one of my books. An old woman says, I wanted to be an old woman sitting on a porch with wonderful memories of what I had done. What scares me is the idea of sitting on a porch with horrible memories of what I had not done. And so in that sense, I'd rather step in the puddle and get my shoe wet and know, well, that's a puddle. And I, you know, I was wrong, but at least I know it now, as opposed to should I, shouldn't I.
Now, your novels never shy away from the big questions. You're always right there. God, love, the meaning of life, you've addressed them all. Do the big questions come out of your characters, or are the characters created to search for the answers to those big questions?
The second. I mean, the characters in the books bump into the big questions. But, you know, a lot of people don't like my books because they do that. They say, how dare you, how pompous, how obnoxious of you to try and address. I mean, for example, in White Apples, I was thinking about what happens to us after we die. And, you know, we're not supposed to do that because that's not our place. But I thought, one of the main things of this book is something that I call the mosaic, which is, you know, my answer to what happens to us after we die. And some of the negative criticism of this book is, how dare he do that? It's really obnoxious. And, you know, what can I say? Too bad. Read another book.
Now, you are good at analogies. You spend a lot of time constructing them. They occupy the center of a lot of your novels. Could you talk about their role in your novels?
I love language. Every day before I go to work, I read poetry, because I always say the poetry is like the hashish of language. It's like this boiled down essence. And the greatest compliment to me of a reader is when they say, like, I underline lines that you wrote, because they're memorable, and I want to keep them, you know, somewhere in my life. And analogies are the same thing. You know, if you compare something well, somebody will say, I always knew that, but I never thought of it. And now he's reminding me of what I already knew. So if when I was teaching, I used to say, you know, your foot falling asleep is like drinking a ginger ale. You know how the bubbles go up your nose and you're kind of fizzy and this and that. It's the same thing when you stand up on that leg that went to sleep, bubbles go up your leg and this and that. And kids would always laugh at that because it would slowly dawn on them the analogy. And I said, it's not mine. It's an old analogy. But suddenly you're putting together two disparate elements, which you never thought of before, but you know what? They do match.
And that's, you use that a lot to help evoke that childlike sense of wonder. You seem to go for moments in your books that are kind of like a big, uh-oh, my God, and the jaw drops, and the reader just sits there for 10 minutes rereading the same paragraph.
Hopefully. Now, a friend of mine who's a writer said something very nice once. He said, most writers write either for the head or for the heart. He says, you write for the O. And I said, what do you mean the O? He says, in every book I've ever read of yours, there's one moment in which the reader goes, oh, like the dogs talk or whatever it is. And I never thought of it that way. I just thought of, this is an organic story, and this is what happens now. And, you know, if the dogs talk, that's okay. I never shy away from that. I never shy away from children flying or dogs talking or whatever it is. If inevitably this seems to happen in most of my books, a moment in which strange things happen, I go, okay, fine, let's do it.
But you don't seem to, on the other hand, direct yourself towards those kind of strange incidents either. Your novels really have a feel of just normal reality.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I remember when I was writing my book, The Wooden Sea, and there was a scene in which a guy goes to the bathroom very late at night, and he hears noises downstairs, and so he goes down to investigate, and he bumps into himself at age 17. And I remember when I wrote that, it was completely unplanned. I said, who is that? He goes, oh, it's himself. And I went, oh, okay. And there was not a moment's pause. Then he starts to have a conversation with himself, age 17, and that became one of the centerpieces of the book.
Now, your novels are set on a bigger stage than lots of novels. Your characters travel to and from Europe, which makes the novels seem much more colorful and interesting than novels just set in a single country in America and Kmart land. You currently reside in Vienna. Could you talk about your global point of view and how that informs your novels?
I don't have a global point of view. You know, people often throw the word expatriate at me, or they look at me sort of suspiciously, like, how could you live almost 30 years of your life outside the country? It reminds me very much of a funny line from the American painter Cy Twombly, who lives in Rome. Twombly once said, as far as Americans are concerned, it's okay to live overseas for a year, but anything longer than that is snobby. And there really is this kind of look like, why would you want to do that? And I always have the naive answer, I'm comfortable there. You know, home is where you're most comfortable. And as far as a global point of view is concerned, I don't really have one. I mean, you know, I speak German, and I watch news in German, and I also watch CNN, so I get it coming from different sides. I think that if you live outside the United States, the world is smaller. You can get on a plane and fly to Bangkok or to Warsaw or whatever it is, and it's no big deal. Whereas for a lot of Americans, it's a big deal. It's like, you know, when I can have my 2-week vacation 5 years from now, I'm going to go see 5 cities in Europe, and you know, that's the difference.
Welcome to Fine Print. We're here with Jonathan Carroll. He's talking about his latest novel, White Apples. You've been hailed by genre fans and associations that your novels, frankly, have little to do with. You are the guest of honor at the World Fantasy Convention. Could you talk about your relationship to genre fiction and its fans?
I will always be beholden to my fans in that group, because basically they're the ones who, in the very beginning, when my first book, Land of Laughs, came out, the book immediately sank into the deep, dark sea, except for the fantasy fans and except for the people who read genre. And they're the ones who kept their copy and handed it to 20 friends and said, you got to read it, and. And nobody else did. Now, you know, you get the kisses from the literary so-and-so and this and that, and I always say, oh no, they were the guys who long ago were the ones who kept me propped up and going and all this stuff. And so, you know, they want me to be their guest at a fantasy convention, I'll go, and I'll go happily, and every time I go, I say thank you to them 42,000 times.
Now, your novels seem ideally suited to film adaptations, and I know you recently spent some time in Southern California writing for films. What's your feeling about seeing your novels adapted into movies?
I must disagree with you. Some people think that my books are movieable, but most of the time what happens is this. Almost all of my books are under option for film, but inevitably what happens is some enthusiastic so-and-so will option one of the books, and then it starts to move through the studios, and inevitably some suit says, no, they're too strange, drop it, and it gets dropped. And as James Ellroy, the crime writer, once said, take the check and run. The nice thing about that is the fact that the money that Hollywood gives you allows you to go home and write another book, and that's terrific. I wrote films in Hollywood for almost 2 years and had the typical experience, which was, you know, nothing got made. I made some money, had a lot of Cobb salad, and left. You know, that was my Hollywood experience.
So you're of the book a room in Vegas and toss the rights over the California border variety of writer these days, then?
I think so. A guy in Hollywood once told me something. I don't know if it's true, but it's very spooky. This studio executive once said to me, at all times, most studios have 1,000 projects under development. Now, when you consider how many films each studio makes per year, the chances of your project being made are minuscule. And so essentially what you do is you go out there, particularly as a novelist, you go out there for the experience, you go out there for the loot, and you go out there for the sun, and that's it. And if it gets made, isn't that astonishing? But to go out there thinking that something's going to happen is dangerous.
Now, you're wildly popular in Europe, in Poland, in Germany. Your collection of short stories was published in Germany almost 2 years before it was in the UK or the US. Could you talk about that?
I think that there are a bunch of writers. I was just talking to someone. There are a bunch of American writers, Paul Auster, T.C. Boyle, John Irving even, who sell many more copies overseas than they do here. Even someone like Irving, who you would think is a big seller, he openly admits his greatest audience is in Germany. I think it's simply because they tend to be more open to stuff that's weird, and weird, you can use that word whichever way you want. Granted, the French think Jerry Lewis is a genius. The French also will publish someone like Paul Auster as a strange but serious writer who you should just read, and we're not going to give any hype about him, but we'll get behind it in, as far as promotion. America has a lot of this feeling of, you know, is he a star? Does he have star quality? Is he worth being in People magazine? And then they think about him as a writer. I notice that Alice Siebold's book, The Lovely Bones, is a big hit here. But every time I read an article about her, it's all about she was raped when she was 20 years old. It's almost like they can't leave that part off because it makes the book less. If it's a good book, then it stands up. And the Europeans seem to, if you've ever seen European books, very rarely do the covers have any pictures on them. They say Joe Blow and his book. Whereas here, it's a whole big production. It's like a movie in your hands, and I think that's the difference.
Do you write in German?
I don't write my books, no. I mean, I write letters in German and things like that, but it's not good enough to do that.
Do you do your own translations?
No. That's a whole other thing. I look at the translations, certainly the German translations, but a funny story was I was in Poland recently for the publication of White Apples there, and the first chapter of White Apples in English is called Chocolate Covered God, and there was a copy of the book on a counter in Polish, and I picked it up and I jokingly said, what's the title of the first chapter in Polish? And the guy looked at it. He said, Red Moose. Well, don't tell me anymore. Let's just leave it there.
Could you talk about the role of dogs and animals in your novels? They play a big part, and it's very enjoyable.
I always think of dogs as being minor angels, and I don't mean that, you know, angels with wings and stuff, but if you define an angel, they always love us, they always forgive us, they're always happy to see us. If you say to a dog at 3 o'clock in the morning, let's go get a pizza, okay. If you say, let's go play ball, okay. If you say, let's go take a walk, okay. If you say, let's go to sleep, he goes, okay. And yet people sort of push it off as, oh, well, it's just a dog. No, it's not just a dog. It's qualities that we wish human beings had, but they don't. And since a dog has them, that, you know, it's just a dog. But they're these kind of holy qualities which we unfortunately dismiss because the thing's walking around on four legs.
And that plays into your novels in an interesting way. Could you talk about how you use animals in your novels?
Yeah, well, animals to me are always a kind of link between the earthly and the holy. You know, they suddenly take on qualities that you didn't expect them to do. I mean, you know, Spot will one moment be patted on the head and he'll walk out the door and fly away. Because I think, you know, it's that image, that idea of them as minor angels. They're capable of doing things that we don't, you know, we don't necessarily think of them as being able to do. But I often think of them as these kind of transitional things. You know, the people in my books have strange things happen to them, and often these things are introduced by animals.
Now, your website, jonathancarroll.com, is actually one of the best author websites I've seen. How did it come into being?
Well, it's a funny story. The guy who created and maintains the website came to interview me for Wired magazine, and he said, actually, I'm using this as a disguise because I want to create this website and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I know nothing. At the time, I knew nothing about websites, internet, all this stuff. I said, go, fine, as long as I don't have to pay for it. He said, no, we're doing it as a labor of love. And I said to him at the time, well, how many hits do you think it'll have in the first year? He said, well, writers don't get so many, and if we're lucky, we'll get about 50,000 hits. The first year, there was almost 800,000 hits, and now we're getting 300,000 a month. So it's like taken over. It has this sort of life of its own, which is both wonderful and a little bit spooky at the same time, because nobody expected that to happen. And with this kind of attention being paid, you almost feel like you got to be on your toes all the time. You know, if you're not, they'll get you.
Well, they are very watchful on the internet, and they're not shy about pointing out things.
Well, that's for sure.
Now, you published a few short stories there. How do you feel as a writer about the economics of giving away your work on the web?
I think that it's okay. I mean, you know, I suppose it's similar to with music. You know, people are just taking stuff and using it. As far as writing is concerned, I put those stories up there knowing that I owed something to the people who go to my website, which is, you know, some new stuff and exposure to things they had never seen before. There's also some movie scripts up there. It's fine. It's fine. I mean, you know, if you make your money elsewhere, then you can afford to do that.
Could you talk about your forthcoming novels? Tell us what we have in store for us.
White Apples is the first part of a trilogy. It's about the first. It's about a family, a man, a woman, and their child. And the first book is about the man. The second book will be about the woman. And the third book will be about the child's life, the way that it looks now. I'm, you know, as the Arabs say, inshallah, you know, if God wills it, then that's what will happen in the next couple of years.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Jonathan Carroll, the author of White Apples.